welcome to Trails Worth Hiking, the show that brings you some of the most interesting backpacking and trekking routes in the world. I'm your host, Jeremy Pendry. In the first part of the show, we bring you the story and history of a trail. Then we tell you what it's like to hike the trail and how you can do it. On this episode, we travel another island hike, but this is a very different island than our last episode in Iceland. This island is just off the coast of one of the United States' largest cities, yet it still feels remote in its own way. We'll travel for several days starting from the island's main town, hiking along the spine of the island where we'll have beautiful views of the Pacific Ocean, camping in groves of trees or descending to camp on beautiful beaches. And we'll have to stay alert to avoid getting trampled by bison. Wait, beaches and bison? Yep. On this episode of Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Trans-Catalina Trail on Catalina Island off the coast of Los Angeles, California. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you for being with me. Feel free to reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com with ideas, comments, criticism, praise, whatever you want to say. I appreciate it all. And please follow us on Instagram at trailsworthhikingpodcast. Let's do our Walking the Walk segment where we talk about listeners who've hiked a trail after being inspired by an episode to get out there and actually hike. I'm happy to say that this report is getting harder and harder for me to put together because more and more of you are getting out there and hiking these trails, which is great. We'll start with Angela McCall. This year, Angela turned 60 years old and thought that she really needed to get after it. And what she meant by that was her dream of spending more time on the trail, which is fantastic. Not everyone gets to 60 and decides, I really need to be out hiking more. So I'm glad Angela is doing that. And she hiked three of the trails that we've covered on the show. So let's see if you can top that one for a Walking the Walk report. She admits that she heard about these trails before listening to the episode, but she happily gleaned information from the episodes, and each episode did help her in her planning and give her a confidence boost to go out and go for it. So I'd say that counts as being inspired by the show, even though she had heard of the trails beforehand. In the end of April and early May, she hiked the Foothills Trail, which is primarily in South Carolina and a little bit in North Carolina. She enjoyed the walk with mountain laurel bushes in full glorious bloom, and she hit the timing pretty well where the rain had subsided and it wasn't too hot yet. She said the trail provided a perfect mix for her of solitude and social interaction. Then in August, Angela hiked the Tahoe Rim Trail. So she went from the Carolinas all the way out to California and Nevada to hike the Tahoe Rim Trail around Lake Tahoe. She started the hike at Tahoe City and went clockwise. After hiking the trail, she said she liked the plan that a lot of hikers had of getting a ride from South Lake to Big Meadow and beginning their hike there, because that gave them the ability to stop both in Tahoe City and South Lake for nice in-town days along the way. But doing this also caused you to have to go through Desolation Wilderness early on, which for a lot of people is what they want to be their finale. Although, you know, I have to say, I like the Desolation Wilderness. It's beautiful, kind of Sierra granite, but it's the only part of the trail where you don't have a view of Lake Tahoe. And this trail really is about Lake Tahoe. So I wouldn't mind starting out the trail and getting Desolation out of the way. You can certainly do Desolation on a separate hike another time and really get a sense of that place. And then only a couple weeks after returning from Tahoe City, she got into her car and road trip to the North Woods of Minnesota to hike the Superior Hiking Trail. Angela started with a pretty significant hike in South Carolina of, I want to say it's something like 77 miles. I can't remember exactly, but somewhere in the 70s. Then the Tahoe Rim Trail is somewhere between 165 to 175. And then she upped her game and hiked the Superior Hiking Trail, which is over 300 miles. So congrats to Angela on all three of her hikes. And that's quite an amazing summer. And she even reported that she did some additional hiking after that. So thank you, Angela, for letting me know about those hikes. You can find the Foothills Trail at episode 16. And the Tahoe Rim Trail is episode 37. And the Superior Hiking Trail is all the way back in episode 8. So there you go, if you want to learn more about any of the hikes that Angela did. I also heard from David Poirier from Montreal. David has reached out to us before when he finished the High Sierra Trail. But this time, David completed the Pemmi Loop in New Hampshire, which we covered in episode 23. He used the info from the episode to help plan the trip. And David used hikingandfishing.com, the website from our guest on the Pemmi Loop episode, Max Damaris. Max's site, hikingandfishing.com, is a great resource for this hike and many others. So check it out. And why not give a listen to episode 23 to learn more about that hike? One thing that David did that I thought was pretty cool is he actually stayed in one of the huts that are along the trail rather than camping. And he really enjoyed that experience and the camaraderie that it brings. So something to consider is doing a hut-to-hut type of hike, even here in the U.S., not just something you can do in Europe or South America. David reports that the hike was very, very difficult, one of the hardest hikes that he's ever done. He also said that you could really go either way, clockwise or counterclockwise, and he might try it the other way around next time. Also, David documented his hike in a YouTube movie. Dave's YouTube channel is Dave en Rondeau. In many of his videos, he does speak in French. David, being from Quebec, does speak French. I understand French and can speak it some, but I have to confess that the Quebecois accent is a little tough for me at times. So sorry, Dave, for saying that, but at times it's a little hard for me, but it's great for me to get some practice in understanding the Canadian French accent by watching Dave's videos. They're fantastic videos, even if you don't speak French, because you can follow along the hike nonetheless pretty easily. And if you speak any French at all, great opportunity to improve your comprehension. So thanks to Dave for sending in that report, and I will leave a link to his YouTube channel in the show notes. I also heard from J.D. Yingling, who hiked the Zion Traverse in Utah. JD listened to episode 26 with our guest Allison Richter to prepare for the trip. And he said that Allison's scouting report was very helpful and pretty much spot on. And he followed her itinerary and it worked out very well for him. So he appreciated the intel that Allison provided about the Zion Traverse. So thanks to JD for that report. And that brings me to Allison Richter, who I just mentioned. A couple of years ago, Allison listened to the episode I had with my daughter about the Kalalau Trail in Kauai, Hawaii, which is episode 4. And Allison and her husband finally got to doing the hike. And they had, let's say, it was an interesting time. On the one hand, they thought it was absolutely beautiful, particularly the beach at the end of the hike, which is the highlight, really. But they found the hike to be extremely difficult and thought that my daughter, Sonia, had understated the difficulty of the hike. And Allison recognized that the difference might be that my daughter at the time was 19, I think, when she hiked that trail. She's now 23, a few years later. But Allison is in her early 50s, and it was a much more difficult hike. And it sounds like they had some difficult weather. And ultimately, the pace of the hike was so slow, and with the rain, that she found the trail to be slick and dangerous, and it took away from the fun quite a bit. So she just wanted to follow up and let us know that it was a super challenging hike, very beautiful. She says even the most beautiful hike that she's done, but the difficulty of it did take away from it for her and her husband. And I'll just say that Allison raises a really good point, which is that a hike can be relatively easy for one person, but could be brutal for someone else. We all have different experiences and skills. We're of different ages and even maybe different generations. We may try the hike at a different season or under vastly different weather conditions, even in the same season. We may try a much more or less ambitious itinerary. We may have more or less time to complete a hike. You know, for example, I once met a guy who finished the John Muir Trail, which is a hike of more than 200 miles. And he finished it in 7 days because that was the time he had off from work to do it. I don't recommend hiking the JMT in 7 days. It took me 15 days and that felt fast, but For some, it can be done, and it's going to be a very different experience if you do it that way. We also may have completely different types of equipment from each other, particularly those that follow an ultralight gear philosophy versus a traditional gear philosophy, which can make an enormous difference on the trail. We might hike solo or with others, and the size and skill level and equipment of the others in our group also all matter quite a bit. So keep all this in mind when listening to an episode. This is why I always tell you at the end of the episode to do your own research, and it's important to know as much as possible about what you're getting into, and even then to have the flexibility to take what comes and to adjust your plans, even mid-hike at times when it's necessary. Allison is not the only one to raise points like this with me. Listener Rachel Embury raised another good point about financial resources, which also may vary vastly among listeners. And she also talked about some changing facts on the ground since the episode that she listened to was recorded. So always keep in mind that things may have changed since I recorded an episode, reservation systems and dates, money required, rerouting of trails, and lots of other things may have changed. So you really do have to figure out what the current info is, even if you are inspired by the episode to want to go do it. For Rachel, she listened to episode 22 about the Tour de Mont Blanc, but found that using the tour company that I had used, or using pretty much any tour company, was prohibitively expensive for her. So for Rachel, the cost may be out of reach to use the kind of company that my family used, and I understand that. And the cost has gone up quite a bit. We've had a ton of inflation over the last few years, so it's not as cheap as it once was. She also said that you really do need to book ahead, even for a small group. She is booking these accommodations in the refuges by herself and not through a company, and she's had some difficulty getting the dates and locations that she wants. And so, look, you know, again, that's another thing that can change. The popularity of a trail can grow, and at times the reservation system can get overwhelmed. So that's just something else to keep in mind. And lastly, I'll mention that listener Peter Van wrote in about the Wonderland Trail. The guest I had on for that episode, which is episode 29, had hiked that trail in 5 days and was essentially an ultralight backpacker. And Peter points out that a more realistic itinerary for the Wonderland Trail is probably 7 to 9 days. And he's probably right. And my guest for that episode was very clear about the fact that he, you know, follows a lightweight philosophy and has an aggressive itinerary. Though I realize that not everyone's going to fully absorb what that means when you're just listening to a podcast episode, you may not fully understand how difficult it would be to do the hike the way that the guest did the hike. Peter is a very experienced hiker of the Wonderland Trail. He's attempted the trail 4 times and completed it twice. So he had a lot of good information about specifics on that trail. And I don't think I'm going to go into all of those specifics. I think I'll just fall back on what I mentioned before, which is my guests may not get everything right. Some of the things, for example, like campsite reservations or resupply points, you may want to look at multiple sources online and try to get a consensus before you make a decision about those things, and even call the ranger station to make sure you understand how it works. So thanks to Peter for writing in about his concerns about the way my show presented the Wonderland Trail. And I think when you put together all of the advice that came in from the various folks I mentioned, it does point to the fact that everyone needs to take responsibility for doing their own research to understand what will be most appropriate for them. And again, I hope this show really just inspires you to get out there and want to do the trail and to do it. But that's the purpose of this show at the end of the day. The information is a good starting point, but it's not the end point. You really should do more to make sure you understand what you're getting into. All right. I know that's a lot, but because I got a few emails of a similar nature, I thought it was worth mentioning. All right. Let's jump into this episode. Our guests on this episode are Rachel and Beth Irvine. Guests, plural. They are sisters. Rachel and Beth are experienced hikers, and I have to say they were a lot of fun to talk to, and so I hope you'll enjoy the conversation as well. We're going to be talking about Catalina Island. So why do I want to do an episode on a hike on Catalina Island off the coast of Long Beach and Los Angeles? Well, I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, for 16 years. I went to college there, to graduate school, and spent my first decade of my working life in Los Angeles. In fact, my first summer working at an internship while I was in graduate school, I went to a retreat with the firm I worked for on Catalina Island. I later went camping on Catalina Island when I had young kids. I learned to scuba dive on Catalina Island. Catalina Island is part of the Channel Islands. My very first backpacking trip was on Santa Cruz Island, also in the Channel Islands. And so I have a lot of connections to the Channel Islands, where Catalina Island is, and to Catalina Island itself. And I've been there, as I said, many times. As a result, I've wanted to do this hike for many, many years. I actually went so far as drawing up an itinerary for the hike years ago, which you'll hear about in the interview. Though to date, I still have not done the hike, but I do have plans to try to do it soon, and I'm hoping that will work out. So let's talk about Santa Catalina Island. Santa Catalina Island is part of the Channel Islands, as I mentioned. It's the easternmost island of that chain of islands. It's roughly 29 miles or 47 kilometers southwest of Long Beach, California. The island itself is 22 miles long, and at its widest point, 8 miles wide. So that's 35 kilometers long and 13 kilometers wide. It has a highest point on the island itself of above 2,000 feet or 640 meters. So it's actually a fairly mountainous island. Catalina Island was never connected to mainland California. So there really wasn't terrestrial wildlife there originally, though over time some species made it there, and there have developed more than 50 endemic species of animals on the island. The island fox is one of them. Plus there are squirrels, mice, and shrews. The southern Pacific rattlesnake is also on the island. There were mule deer that were introduced to the island in the 1920s and today have a very high population density. The human history of the island goes back around 9,000 years. At the time of first contact with Europeans, the Tongva people lived on the island. They called the island Pimu, and they called themselves Pimugnans. The Tongva mined and traded soapstone with tribes on mainland California. The first European to set foot on the island was the explorer Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo. Cabrillo is an interesting character for a few reasons, and particularly to me. Some debate his origin. It seems likely that he was Portuguese, even though he sailed under the Spanish flag in a Spanish expedition. He is interesting to me because I went to Juan Cabrillo Elementary School, where I grew up in Pacifica, California. Although at the time, and I think probably even today, we called it Cabrillo because we didn't understand anything about Spanish pronunciation, and many people who go there may still not understand that. And who knows, maybe Cabrillo pronounced it slightly differently in Portuguese. I don't know. When Cabrillo landed on Catalina Island, he actually named the island San Salvador, and this was in 1542. But more than 50 years later, Spanish explorer Sebastian Vizcaino landed there on the eve of St. Catherine's Day and named the island after her. So it became Santa Catalina Island, or rather, as we call it today, really just Catalina Island, which is the name that has stuck. Over time, the island served as a base for otter and seal pelt hunters, including even Russians from the Aleutian Islands who made it all the way there, as well as plenty of pirates that liked its hidden coves. In the 19th century, the island went through a number of different hands and went from being Mexican territory to United States territory. But by the end of the 19th century, it was basically just used for cattle ranching and little else. That brings us to an interesting story about its 20th century development into a tourist destination. But to tell you that story, we go back to 1861 to a Quaker family in Pennsylvania. There was a young and ambitious man born in 1861 in Pennsylvania in that Quaker family. A young man moved to Chicago with only $32 in his pocket. He started a soap company that was modestly successful. He later switched to selling baking powder, which turned out to be more profitable. But as part of the baking powder he sold, he included 2 packs of chewing gum with each can of baking powder. And consumers, it turned out, really wanted the gum. And the fortune of William Wrigley was born, and the rest, as they say, is history. Yes, that Wrigley. It's not clear to me about how Wrigley heard about Catalina Island, but William Wrigley ended up buying shares in the ownership of the island sight unseen, meaning he had never been to the island when he originally invested in the company that owned it at the time. Once he actually visited the island, though, he fell in love with it and bought a controlling interest in the company that then owned the island. Wrigley arrived at Catalina Island in 1919. At the time, the town of Avalon was already established. In 1920, Wrigley built the Hotel Atwater, which I believe was his wife's maiden name. And that is a luxury hotel that is still there today. I think it was actually renovated recently. As you may know, Wrigley also owned the Chicago Cubs, who still play at Wrigley Field in Chicago today. In fact, beginning in 1921, the Chicago Cubs held their spring training on Catalina Island and did so for the next 30 years. Wrigley invested heavily in making Catalina Island a tourist destination. Most famously, he built the Catalina Casino, which had one of the world's largest circular ballrooms and the first theater designed to show talking motion pictures. Despite its name, it was never a gambling casino. The word casino in Spanish can also mean a gathering or meeting place, and that was the sense in which it was named. The Catalina Casino is an Art Deco and Mediterranean Revival style building. It's the height of a 12-story building, and it has the giant ballroom on the top floor. It's a round building built on a point at the edge of the harbor in Avalon, and it is still an iconic building today that when you see it, you recognize it as the sort of hallmark of Catalina Island. Casino Point, which is the water area just off of where the building is, has a great kelp forest, which is sectioned off as a diving park. And that's where I did my dive certification training back once upon a time when I thought I'd be interested in scuba diving. Side note, I got seasick every time I went scuba diving, mostly just from the feeling of weightlessness underwater, more than from the surface, but also from the surface. Anyway, I do fine at altitude. I don't get sick at altitude, but I certainly do get seasick. So my scuba diving career was short-lived. Wrigley also enticed Hollywood to film on the island. For one movie in the 1920s called The Vanishing American, they brought 14 bison to the island for the filming in 1924, and the bison never left. Today, there is a herd of about 150 bison roaming the island. Film production companies also planted non-native palm trees in two harbors, which is the smaller village on the island, that are still there today. And those were used for a Tahitian village scene in Mutiny on the Bounty. Wrigley also put up a mansion, his summer home, on top of Mount Ada, which was named after his wife. He used the same architect who had designed Wrigley Field in Chicago. When he died at 70 in 1932, there was a 130-foot monument built on the island to hold his remains. I actually hiked to that monument and found it and read the plaque on it before having known that Wrigley had ever had anything to do with the island. So it was kind of a real-time discovery for me when I was hiking at Hermit Gulch and came upon the monument. Although he's no longer buried there, his family eventually moved his remains to a cemetery on the mainland. Wrigley's son, Philip, took over the business and the Santa Catalina Island Company, and that company is today still owned by the Wrigley family. The island today has more than 4,000 inhabitants, mostly in Avalon. In 1972, Philip Wrigley deeded 42,000 acres of the island to the Catalina Island Conservancy, a nonprofit he had established. It's the oldest and largest land trust in Southern California. The mission of the Conservancy is to be a responsible steward of the land through a balance of conservation, education, and recreation. Today, over 1 million people a year travel to Catalina Island. The Trans-Catalina Trail was officially opened in April 2009. All right, with that background, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Rachel and Beth Irvine. Rachel and Beth Irvine, welcome to the show. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You guys are from Arizona?
Yeah, we grew up here pretty much the whole time. We've lived other places, but yeah.
Grown up in Northern Arizona.
And so how did you get into outdoor stuff like backpacking, and when did that start?
I think it was just it's always been a part of our lives. I remember, we camped and stuff growing up, hiked, but then I guess it was early adults. We just started, we're like, hey, let's put things on our back and walk places.
And I also went to a school in Montana, and actually part of their program is that you do a week-long trip. And so that was a good entry for me because they kind of just were like, here's some trail mix and Pop-Tarts. And they had a liter, and I think my pack was insane how much it weighed.
Yeah.
But we did like 50 miles or something. And so that was kind of like, do I like this or not? But then, you know, I'm a glutton for punishment. So
that's one of the things I've heard a lot of people say is how brutal their first trip was. And yeah, that's how you can divide the people who love backpacking and the people who hate it. Because the people who love it have an awful, or not an awful experience, but a difficult first experience and still love
and
it. Then they decide, I'm going to figure out how to do it better. And they really want to come back, and it's a challenge. And some people never do it again after a first experience like that, where it was a heavy pack or something.
Yeah, I remember one of my first was with a group of high school students, and we packed canned food. And then the guy who was supposed to be the adult in the situation took us on the wrong trail, and it was just basically straight up a mountain in Colorado, and we all had canned food in our packs, and it was horrible, but I loved it.
See, there you go. All right, so you guys live in Arizona, but how did you learn about the Trans Catalina Trail that's off the coast of California?
I'm an emergency room nurse, and I was travel nursing there, so I had a contract on the island. So I lived there, and I would hike and ride my bike all around the island. But then I was like, hey, there's the Trans Catalina Trail you can backpack. So Rachel came over, and we did it together. And still, I think, one of my favorites that we've done, for sure.
That's really cool. So you were working in Avalon?
Yeah, so there's one tiny hospital in Avalon, and I just happened to get a contract there in 2020, and it was amazing. I would just go snorkeling. I worked nights, and I would go snorkeling after work or ride my bike up to where the buffalo are and ride around or just hike in random canyons and stuff. It was just amazing.
It was like she was at camp.
Yeah, it was camp.
How long were you working there?
3 months.
Okay, cool. So what did you guys do to plan the hike once you decided you wanted to do it?
I think the biggest thing, it's all logistics is what I think makes this trail difficult. So first of all, getting you there, because you have to take a boat and get over there. But then getting the campsite set up, I think, is the number one thing you have to do. Before you do anything else, you need to get your campsites reserved, because they fill up fast. And if you have one in Blackjack and one in Two Harbors, but you're going to miss the middle one, that would be a bummer. That'd be a really long day.
How long in advance did you reserve the campsites?
I can't remember. I think it was a couple of months, like we talked about doing.
Maybe like 2 months or so.
If you do that, you're good. Everything else can fall into place, but getting the campsite set is important.
But it was also during 2020, so like trying to get to California. And then I took a night train, like Amtrak from here, because I was working. And so I left, took a night train, and then had to
It was planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah, public transportation from, you know, the train station in L.A. down to where I could get the ferry. And then, it was a long trip.
I have to confess, this is the trail I've wanted to do for a long time.
Oh, really?
I lived in L.A. for a long time, years and years ago. I've been to Catalina Island a number of times back when I lived in Southern California, and I've really wanted to do this trail for a long time, and I've planned it. This is going to make really bad audio, but I'll hold up and show you. I even planned out a day-to-day itinerary, and this is from years ago. I have this piece of paper. Yeah, I have this piece of paper from years ago where I had planned this hike, and I have never done it. And as soon as I got you guys to come on the show, I talked to my wife, and I told her, she's a teacher, and I said, okay, next spring break, we're doing this.
Absolutely. Oh,
yeah. And she said, okay. So I'm really excited about this interview. So that I can be prepared for it.
That's really cool.
That's awesome.
All right. So it sounds like you guys hike together a lot. Have you guys hiked together a lot over the years? Is that something, do you guys hike with other folks, or is it like always the two of you?
Oh no, it's a mix of friends and everything, or just the two of us. But yeah, we hike all the time.
And we were trying to do, that's kind of what led you to end up in Catalina, was because we were supposed to do the Arizona Trail through hike. And then 2 weeks before we were supposed to start, I had an accident that kind of crushed some cartilage in my knee and stuff like that. So we started.
So of course, you with a messed up knee, we still were like, we're going to do it anyway. And we did 100 miles of the AZT and had to stop. So
your knee just wouldn't take it after 100 miles.
No.
Yeah. And it, I mean, even before I kept trying to keep going on it and they finally did. I mean, it would be like a mile and then it would be like up or down, no pressure on it. And I was like, I cannot believe, you know.
So we made it to Patagonia, Arizona and spent a few days at Goatlandia Airbnb, crazy ladies Airbnb with like goats wandering around and trying to rest and stretch her knee and everything. But I did one more overnight and then she met me at that side and we just called it quits.
Okay. Well, maybe someday in the future, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope to section hike it at least. So maybe like four more sections or something because it's 800 miles total.
Yeah. That's a long one. That's a big hike.
Yeah. Yeah.
What time of year did you guys do the Trans Catalina Trail?
We did it in July.
Not recommended.
I don't know. I still think it was okay.
Yeah.
Because you end up almost every day, you end up at the ocean. So it was fine. I think more people do it spring or fall. Spring, of course, the island would be really green and beautiful. The grass was all pretty withered in the sun when we did it, but it without a doubt was still absolutely gorgeous. So it would just be more gorgeous in the spring and less hot.
There were crispy sections for
crispy,
sure.
Crispy sections.
Do you think in the spring there'd be a lot of fog?
That's the thing is they talked a lot. I was there August to October, and a lot of the islanders or people that live there were talking about June gloom, but I don't know about earlier than that.
Okay.
But definitely June is almost all fog all the time.
Okay. So how big of a hike is this?
It's not bad. It's like 38 total. Yeah, 38 and a half total.
We ended up doing more.
Why?
Why? Oh, because we had to hike back to, you kind of have to hike.
No, I think that's with hiking back. Yeah.
That counts the return?
Yeah, counts the return to Two Harbors.
Well, I think that figure gets you to Parsons and back to Two Harbors. But people used to go out to the very end, to the, I think it's Starlight
Beach.
Is it called Land's End? Or Starlight
Land's
Beach,
End
maybe?
Starlight Beach, yeah. I never made it there, which I have to do another contract out there because we have more to see. But
okay, so it's about 38 and a half miles. And how many days did you guys take to do it?
3 days.
Okay. And what would you recommend for most people?
Who's most people? I think 3 days is perfect, honestly.
Okay.
You could do it. Oh, there's some thunder. Did you hear that?
I did. That's cool.
I think 3 days was totally fun. Of course, you could do a layover in a cool spot, and that would be awesome.
I think the difference, and this is where, I mean, it would be different nowadays, is that we were going during like COVID. It was July of that year. Mm-hmm. So everything was closed. So even when you get into, is it Twin Harbors?
Two Harbors.
It's not like there's much to do and everything's pretty shut down. You couldn't
That's
really go.
True.
It was like one person at a time in a store.
Right.
So I think that affects it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause typically there's a restaurant, there's a store, like a grocery store there. And then in other parts, I think up by Blackjack, there's the airport has a restaurant or something.
Yeah, you hike through there, and we stopped there.
We did eat.
And I think I took a little hoe bath in the bathroom. Just, wiped myself down in the sink because we were so hot.
Y'all remember that now, if anyone there is listening.
No, they don't know. They don't know.
No, that actually, the restaurant was going then, but you just had to go one at a time and sit outside.
So how much up and down is this hike? And I don't mean necessarily in specific numbers, but what does it feel like? Like, does it feel like a pretty up and down hike, or is it most of the time not so bad?
I was going to say emotionally or there's a good amount of up and down. I think we did fine because we have high elevation lungs. We live at 7,000 feet in Flagstaff, Arizona. So then it was just like, this is fine. Yeah, you're hiking uphill, but it felt fine. It's long uphills, but there's some pretty big climbs to tackle.
But we have to tell the truth here. And that last, there's the last day before you get to Parsons, we should have gone over the big.
I think you're.
No, we didn't. There's one portion of the trail that either you can go around on
the truth.
The road,
Okay, so once
are you guys going to have an argument right in the middle of the interview?
Yes.
Well, can you pause this? Can you pause this?
Once you hit two harbors, you can go basically, it's like a loop to Parsons Landing.
Okay.
And you go left, and that's considered Silver Peak Trail, and that's a monster climb as well. And we had spent extra time in Two Harbors because of her knee, and so we just did the coastal on the right there and back. Okay. And we didn't do that last elevation.
It was also closed because remember, we were like, okay, what should we do? Because my knee still had been, we started the Arizona Trail in March of this year.
2020.
So it wasn't, I was still kind of technically recovering, but we were like, what should we do? And the lady said, oh, it's actually closed because of landslides. And we said, oh, perfect.
We're all, we don't have to do it.
I don't have to decide. So we missed that last one. That's a pretty big climb.
The very last climb. Yeah.
And she also said you should start really early on that. So that's something for everyone to know. Like,
your two harbors day on for that big hill.
Yeah. Because of the warmth and stuff. She's like, you shouldn't try it that late in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So.
What about gear for this trip? Is there anything in particular to think about?
I didn't really feel like there's anything special. The cool thing about this trip is every campsite except for the very last has water.
Okay.
Running water. So you're not worried about filtering or anything like that. And then there's places in between you can get water. So water's not really an issue. And then, yeah, I didn't need a raincoat. I didn't need bug spray.
What about food storage? Is there, for example, are there boxes at the campsites to protect against? I don't know if there, I know there's foxes. I don't know if there's raccoons or anything like that.
I don't think there's the foxes. There are at any of the beach campsites, there's the boxes, with the special opening things, except Blackjack doesn't have them. And I think they just don't have as many issues there.
Okay.
Also on the last day at Parsons, you paid to have water left in one of those.
Yeah, when you make your reservation, I have two things that everybody should know. Your reservation at Little Harbor, absolutely get a spot at Shark Harbor when you're reserving it.
What is that?
So it's just a little extension, and it's basically a private beach with three or four campsites. So when you go to make your reservations, you click on Little Harbor to make your camping reservation. Mm-hmm. And there's like three or four sites off to the left that's Shark Harbor. And it's literally like a private beach. When I was just backpacking, not this trip together, but on one of the days when I was working there, I backpacked in and I was the only person on the beach. So do Shark Harbor, because Little Harbor tends to be kind of a zoo. There's a lot of people there, people who just drove, people who didn't backpack, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But Shark Harbor is amazing. And then I tell everyone, they don't know, but you add having wood delivered to your camp reservation, and then they deliver wood to you, and then you can have a campfire.
Cool. Is that at Little Harbor or at Parsons or both?
So Little Harbor, get the Shark Harbor sites and deliver wood. And then Parsons, you can pay for wood and water, and you pick it up in a locker when you get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there must be no water available at all at Parsons then, if you have to have water.
No. There. No water at Parsons. So you get like X amount of gallons, and you have everything you need. And that was a chillier campsite too. It's at the north end of the island, and all the wind's blowing at you. So
what was funny though is we had kept meeting this pair of hikers, and she was just the one girl, you always end up meeting interesting people, but she had a lot to say, and she kept telling us, oh, you're going to Parsons. Yeah. Like you're going to die in the sun.
It was like this ominous, every time we saw her, we're like, oh my gosh.
And she said, well, there's nowhere to hide. There's nothing.
And so we're like, this is kind of nice.
We got there and we're like, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
There's no, the sun wasn't out. It worked out well for us because we definitely thought we were going to die
based on her encounters.
Well, at least it eliminates people like her being out there to bother you.
Exactly.
Yes.
What about navigation? Is it pretty easy to follow the trail, or can you make wrong turns pretty easily? How did you do that?
It's really easy to follow. I think it's pretty well marked. The trail at times does cross over some dirt roads, so you just have to be sure, like if you have the All Trails app or whatever, that you're like, okay, we continue this way. But I think it's very well marked.
There were a few places where you're on a road for a little bit, and then it would.
With me?
No, we're not arguing. Don't talk over me. there was like, so a couple times, because there was one guy who missed the trail and ended up walking into the
airport.
The harbor one, because he had just like walked on the road the whole time, so he was like, he missed all this beautiful landscape, because so it's just kind of catching it, getting back on the trail sometimes can be tricky. Just pay attention to signs. So
did you use the All Trails app also?
I think that's what I was using. I had the waterproof physical map and then the All Trails app.
Okay. And then, so explain the getting to the island part for people who haven't been to Catalina Island. And I guess that's more Rachel, because you were already there, Beth. But getting there for the hike.
Yeah. You have to take the ferry or take a helicopter. Those are basically your ways in.
I think most people are probably taking the ferry.
Taking the ferry. And it goes from, I think you go to make all your camping reservations and your boat ferry reservations. It's all Catalina Island Company online. And the ferry leaves from a couple different places, Long Beach and somewhere more south. And I think that might be it.
I've been there before. This isn't the first time I've been there. And it's always been out of Long Beach that I've taken it. I did take a helicopter out, which is kind of another part
story.
Of
the story.
Because when I showed up, Beth and I had crossed lines of as far as like my timing of when I had a train back. And also the day that when we would finish the hike. So I was like, I have to be back to work on Friday.
And we had gotten her a ferry back on the wrong day. Uh-huh. And the only way to get her off the island was a helicopter.
Well, I think the problem was they had shut down a lot of the ferries. So there was like one per day. So you would have one ferry. And I remember being like, I have to get back to get a train. Well, then when I took the we were running, we basically took one of those turbo engine boats.
Yeah.
And then I was so surprised though, if you look it up, I was shocked at how inexpensive for being a helicopter ride is.
It was, you'd think, oh my gosh, it's going to be so expensive. It wasn't bad. So that's
interesting. Yeah. So you went back to Avalon and went from there, because I think what most people would do is probably, I think at San Pedro, if you take the ferry from San Pedro rather than Long Beach, you can actually go back from two harbors instead of Avalon. So you can take a different ferry back.
And you
Again, I think it was because so much was shut down. There was like one option in, one option out. So we were kind of, because even with and then my eardrum broke in the helicopter ride. Everything was great this trip until we started to fly back. And then I broke my eardrum
I think a lot of people do the hike and then get a boat back to Avalon, because Avalon, you have more places to eat, more things to do. And so you end up and you can kind of like get cleaned up and whatever. So
that's actually a good idea. You could spend another night in Avalon, get a hotel, get cleaned up, and then take the regular ferry back the next day.
Yeah, there's a lot of good restaurants there that I really loved. And so I think that's kind of you can do it any way you want, but that's a good way to do it.
So to be clear about the hike for people who haven't been there, when you're going from Avalon toward two harbors, you're going from south to north, right?
Yep.
Is that really the only way to do this? Is that the only way people probably do this?
I think for the most part. The other way, I'm not sure. This way you can start with supplies from Avalon. There's also a little campground at the very north part of Avalon if you're not going to get an Airbnb that first night or whatever.
I think I've stayed there. I've camped there. It's called Hermit Gulch. Is that the one?
Yeah, Hermit Gulch.
Yeah.
So I just think that this way is kind of the way to go.
Okay. And I don't think there are permits for the hike itself. So it's really about getting the campsites reserved, right?
Actually, you do need a permit now, but it is free.
Okay.
So you go to Catalina Island Conservancy or whatever, and you get the permit through them. And it doesn't cost anything.
Do you have to do that in advance, or do you just show up and they give you a permit?
I do it in advance because I'm not sure, but I think they limit the amount of people so that they don't have like 100 people, starting off on the same day or whatever.
But it seems like they would be, that seems silly. I mean, for them, because.
I'm just making stuff up, actually. Because confidently.
Because you have to camp at a campsite. All right.
Let's switch to what this area looks like. So a lot of people may have not been to Catalina Island. A lot of people may not even have known that there were islands off the coast of Southern California, some of which are part of Channel Islands National Park. And then you have Catalina Island, which actually has a real town, a full site. I think there are thousands, I don't know, maybe 5,000 people or something like that live there.
Yeah.
And I'm just making that number up, but it's something somewhere.
I believe you.
Somewhere in that ballpark. So for people who've never been to this area, what is Catalina Island and what does this look like?
I'm not making this up. I just don't know the exact words. It's like a desert island, a high desert island. It has rattlesnakes. It has not natural buffalo from a 1920s movie, and they couldn't ship them back. And so you have to watch out for snakes. There's cactus and all that. But then the crazy thing is, like, your first day, you hike up from Avalon, and then you get to Blackjack, and it's pine trees. Beautiful pine trees and everything. So there's a lot of variation to the areas of the island.
Yeah, I felt like you kind of go through so many different climates. And I think it's interesting because if you kind of know, and I know for that you do the history of the islands, but just how much is not native, you know, like how many like invasive species that they had. So they brought in another one to kind of get rid of that one. And yeah. So it's just like this wild combination of, you're just like, what is happening on this island? Why do we have such a weird combination of, well, the foxes are, I guess, they're native.
Yeah.
They can stay.
And what about, were you able to see anything offshore, like whales or sea lions or things like that, since you're on the coast or you're seeing the coast a lot of the time?
We never saw any whales.
I saw
sea lions.
I saw dolphins and otters when I was on the ferry. Oh. And then I thought I saw a lot of whales, but it was actually waves. So, Arizona, so.
You mentioned that there are buffalo on the island that have been there since a 1920s film. Are they fenced or are they basically just wild and you have to be careful?
Oh, you have to be careful. They roam around. There are none in Avalon. So Avalon is down like this bay and you have to go up to the top of the hills basically to get to other parts of the island if you're walking or driving. And so once you get that first climb out of the way, it's fair game. You're going to run into buffalo, and there's signs everywhere. And they're like, you know, buffalo are big, dangerous animals. And it's like, practice hiding behind things.
Or it says, yeah, basically it says, always look for a hiding spot, like a good hiding spot, which I had a big straw hat I bought. Cause I was like, I forgot a hat. So we in Avalon bought this big straw hat. And so we can send you these pictures, but we started this thing of me hiding behind things, but all you could see was my hat.
It's just like, this hat poking out behind, like, a pole
or an old phone booth or something like a actual
that's funny
little phone booth thing. Yeah, so
and we had at least two pretty significant times that we had to go way off trail to go around buffalo because they're not moving.
And yeah. The other one we had one that there were two facing off in, it was a pretty big herd, but two bigger males facing each other, like, and the trail was between them.
Yeah.
And so this guy who was working for he was like park service or something. He finally went and he was like yelling at him to move.
Yeah.
So we're like, oh good, they're going to move. And the one turns and just starts at us.
Chomping at
and
us,
so yeah. We like ran into a tree, and it was like this low tree that you can like hide in like a fort. And this thing's circling around.
It's just and crazy.
Yeah. She was recording it. And finally the guy's like, after a while, he's like, all right, you can come out.
So you run into them all the time, but so you just kind of have to be careful going around corners and stuff.
Yeah.
Are they only in the part above Avalon or are they pretty much on the whole island?
So above all the middle section of the island,
okay.
Above Avalon, all of those areas, two harbors. And then I don't believe there's any on that kind of northern tip of the island past two harbors.
Okay.
We have to go through town.
The other one, which I think is a funny story, was that right after that encounter, there was a family, they had two boys with them. And so on this part of the trail,
which are like loops.
We kind of looped around so we could see them walking and you can kind of hear each other talking. And the boys were up ahead and this one buffalo had moved to the hillside, right? And it was around a corner. So these kids are coming around a corner. And there's a buffalo on the other side, you know, so we see it. And so we start yelling. We're like, hey, hey, buffalo.
Like waving our arms.
And then the boys, they look over and they're all, oh, hello. Being like, no, buffalo. And they're all, hello. So the dad was like, oh, no. He's like, come here, guys. I think there's a buffalo. But yeah, it was just like,
buffalo,
you're just.
Buffalo, hello. So
the rest of the trip, we'd be like, buffalo, hello.
That was funny.
So tell me about your itinerary for this trip. You start in Avalon and the first day is all the way to Blackjack, right?
Yeah, first day to Blackjack. And then you take the wrong campsite. And that's what we did. And then we'll tell you that story, I guess. But then second day, we hiked to Little Harbor. There's nowhere to camp in between, and you can't camp off trail. You have to camp in designated areas.
Okay.
And then the last day, we did Little Harbor to Parsons.
And then back to Two Harbors? No, you stayed at Parsons.
Stayed at Parsons overnight, back to Two Harbors, took the boat to Avalon.
How far is it from Parsons to Two Harbors, roughly?
That one we took.
Wasn't bad.
I think we did that, and because we got up early, we had to catch the turbo boat. Mm-hmm. So I think it took like 2 hours, 3 hours. It wasn't bad. Okay. Like that was not rushing.
It's more of a flat Two Harbors to Parsons. If when you're doing that one that goes along the coast instead of the up and over, it's pretty flat.
Okay, so really, you guys did have 3 nights, but you actually had kind of a fourth or part of a fourth day to get back to Two Harbors.
Tromping back, yeah.
Okay,
that's true.
All right. And so on the Avalon to Blackjack part, this is pretty much getting uphill from Avalon and then across above Avalon.
Yeah. You have a pretty steep, especially in the heat, trip up to the top of the hill. And then it's up and down and up and down, but not too bad. And then on your way, there is the recreation area, Hay Press, and you can get water there as well.
Okay.
Or so, take a little shower.
Take a little shower, which we did because it's very hot.
And then you said the campground of Blackjack, it sounds like it's a pretty nice place. It's got pine trees. And then you guys, of course, really stole beautiful. Somebody else's campsite.
Oh, well, he sure picked did. Up on that.
So we got in pretty late, or we got in later evening, and we were like...
Don't make excuses.
No, it was late. We were like, oh, that's our campsite. That kind of sucks. Look at that one. It has a tire swing at it. Like, nobody else is going to show up. It's evening. Which late.
It was a bad decision.
It was a bad decision. It was a decision after hiking in very hot heat all day. And so we put our tent up in this other campsite. Then Rachel elbows me awake like 3 hours into sleeping and it's dark. And all these boys had showed up and they were so livid. We're in their campsite.
Well, they're trying to figure out where it was. And I was like, should we say something? And
she's like, should we say something? I'm like, shut up.
I was like, because... And then we got up really early and left before they got out of their hammocks.
Well, no, the one guy was up and he was mean mugging us for sure.
It was just one of those things where you look back, you're like, that was really stupid.
It was so dumb and I don't even know why we made the decision. We could have used the tire swing without camping there.
I think you want to know the real reason why we did it.
Why?
Because there was this couple that was right next to us.
Oh,
and
that
was like
why.
They were on their honeymoon.
They were
and
so
it was like
annoying.
Our campsite was right next to them. I was like, man, we're going to have to, there's nobody out on this whole area. There's
yeah, like they were annoying just to be like within 10 feet of. And that was the reason. We were like, we don't want to camp next to these guys.
Listen to you guys tell this story. I'm trying to decide whether I would love going hiking with you guys or hate going hiking with you guys. And I'm not sure I can decide yet. I don't know.
You know what? Is that a compliment or not?
I don't know.
Maybe by the end, we'll ask you the question. Would you go hiking?
So that, you guys you guys used the tire swing at least. They got there 3 hours later. They never would have used it. At least it got used.
They never would have used it. And that's the truth.
And we had a lot of fun times and pictures. And the lovers were in Lover's Cove.
Yeah,
and we
alone.
Didn't have to deal with it.
All right. So that looks like it's about almost 11 miles that first day.
Yes.
And then Blackjack to Little Harbor the next day. That's not very far, right? It's a pretty short day.
It is. And it's like a lot of downhill. So that's your easy day. That was a really pretty day. I like that one.
It's very
you're
crispy.
Hiking, it's crispy, but you kind of go up and down in these hills. And again, then you're in this different palm tree-ish stuff. And I don't know. I loved it.
I think the thing that's cool too is like, it's so weird that you're on such a small island. So you get up a hill and you see the ocean on one side and then you kind of are like, oh, now we're inland. And then an hour later, oh, this is the ocean on this side. So you kind of like have these ocean views.
It's beautiful.
It's pretty rare that you don't at least see it on one side or the other. So that was cool.
And you said Little Harbor, you actually got to stay in Shark's Cove? This sort of...
Not on this trip.
No, not on this trip. Okay.
No, I stayed there. I would just, since I was living there, I would look and see when there was one night open and just snag it and hike over there. So I got to stay there quite a bit and it was fantastic.
I think that
unfortunately
was
ours we didn't get to.
And it wasn't too bad. It was definitely a different feeling because you're backpacking and you show up and there's like...
Literally like... We're talking inflatable couches here.
Yeah. However long.
These people are clearly driving there.
Wait, were you there on a weekend night? I'm wondering if it's a little better during the week.
It was a weekday because I be back Friday.
Yeah. It's a big campground.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot. It's like a little city.
So that's why make your entire trip around getting the Shark Harbor site, I would say.
Okay. All right. That's good advice.
Shark Harbor is literally one of the most magical places I've ever camped.
I guess a good thing, though, too, is you are right next to Shark Harbor and you're near the harbor. So, like, we went down and
hung out. You can go down there and hang out for sure. That's totally fine. And get away from the inflatable couches.
Now, wait, are the inflatable couches, are they sitting out in the harbor in them? Or are these, like, just on their in their campsites?
Just in their campsite.
There was an inflatable unicorn in the harbor.
Nice.
Yeah, there was.
All right, so then the third day you go from Little Harbor all the way out to Parsons and you cross through two harbors where there's another campsite area that people could decide to stay in.
There is. I would have to say this is the campsite I was absolutely least impressed with. It was just crispy. It was just mostly dirt. Like, it just looked like a really hot bummer of a place to stay.
I've seen it actually from the water. I was with a friend once on a boat coming into Two Harbors, and it's just like level dirt with nothing, right?
To me, I was like, there is no appeal to camping here. I wouldn't do it. I would spend two nights in Shark Harbor or two nights at Parsons or whatever, but I wouldn't camp there yet.
And it was all, I think the appeal for people might be that you are so close to more like you can stop and have
if it's your jam, that's or if totally you want to be fine.
In a city, kind of, and they have showers there. You can take a shower.
There's a lot more you can do. You could go get a meal. You can do all that stuff. It's just not my style.
But you could do that. I guess the way now that I'm thinking through how I might want to do this is maybe stop in Two Harbors at the grocery store, or whatever, just to get what I need for the night. Like, use it as a lunch stop, essentially.
Yeah, then that's what we did. Is we grabbed some lunch in Two Harbors, and it was pretty cool.
Okay. And then how big of a day is that to go from Little Harbor to Two Harbors and then to Parsons? Is that a pretty substantial hiking day?
It's a substantial day if you did the last mountain that we skipped. Because that's going to be your highest climb, actually, by a good amount. And so you would be going over two pretty big mountains. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to call it mountain, but, you know, it's from sea level up. So, but you would have a lot of climbing because it'd be.
And that first climb out of which one was that from?
That's Little Harbor.
From Little Harbor. That was a really cool day, too, because it was so foggy on that side. And so it wasn't really hot. Mm-hmm. And then it would clear up and you could see. But I mean, you were steady. You're climbing a lot.
Steady climb.
You know, you're just heading up. And then, you just go straight down to the harbor, and then we're like, okay, we're gonna go straight back up. But I think if you started early enough, mm-hmm. and then you got to, you know, and it wasn't too hot, because that's what they kind of basically said, like, it's not advised to start the second hike up that mountain if it's too hot.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do it,
but it's doable. I think if it wasn't hot, we would have pushed through, and if it was open.
It sounds like you guys really liked Parsons. That was a good spot.
I did like Parsons. It was just, it felt really remote. And it was just beautiful. You had looking at all that ocean and not many people around.
Yeah. And it definitely feels like one of the most remote. I think there's only like six sites total or something.
It's not very many. Because I don't know that everyone goes all the way out.
And there. I think the other thing too that's nice, because you actually are so close to the water that even though there are people, it's the ocean sounds kind of like drown out a lot. So I think that was the nice part too. It's just like, you're okay, cool.
Definitely get your firewood for there, because the fire there was really nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Is the fire actually on the beach? Would you have it on the beach or?
Yeah, you have a little fire ring. There's fire rings, but you're just sitting in the sand basically.
Cool. So after having done this trail, why do you think this is a trail other people should think about doing?
Not only is it gorgeous, you're hiking across an island and it's all this varied terrain and beautiful stuff to see, but I think it'd be a really great trail to start backpacking, because you have water, you have resources. A lot of the hikes we do that we enjoy, you're filtering your water, you have to make sure you have enough food. This would be, I think it'd be a fantastic trail to start backpacking on.
Is there a particular moment or memory that you guys have besides like encounters with buffalo that that sticks with you from the trip, or maybe that's the one that sticks with you? I don't know.
I think that was definitely a big one with the buffalo, because you just come around the corner, and there was a couple times we had to skirt around one that was standing 2 feet from the trail.
It keeps it interesting.
Yeah, you're definitely more alert. It's like flatlands, but then it's like when you're hiking in grizzly country, but it's like a whole different.
Yeah.
Kind of similar, but.
I really loved, oh gosh, there's just like specific views I can remember, and there's so many, it's hard to pick. But when you are hiking from Two Harbors to Parsons, if you're on the side that's the roadside, not over the mountain, you're looking down into Emerald Bay and all these places, and it's just this crystal, beautiful green, blue water, and that was beautiful.
Yeah, there's some really good areas over there. I think that one day, even though it was the crispiest when we went into, I keep calling it crispy.
It really was.
It really was pretty crispy.
What does that mean?
It's just like the grass.
Crunchy.
That's an Arizona word,
grass.
I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Phoenix in the summer. Yeah. No, it was just like, yeah, the grass is like not green. But I think when we were going into the Shark or the Little Harbor, even though it was like one of the more dry days, I think it was just like this, it's kind of cool to go into this oasis after you've been on this like pretty hot section and you see the ocean from afar, far away. And you're like, is there going to be a nice place to camp? And you end up like camping under a palm tree.
Yeah.
This is great. Okay. This worked out.
Looking back on it, is there anything you guys would have done differently based on your experience? If you were telling someone else how to plan doing this trip, I know it sounds like getting that Shark Cove or
Shark Harbor.
Shark Harbor. Getting the Shark Harbor reservation would be a good idea. But anything else that you think you'd ask that people should do differently than what you guys did?
I don't think so. Other than not getting that Shark Harbor site, I think. What would we do wrong?
No, I was going to say. I was actually going to say, I think, because you were talking about why people should hike it, and I didn't get to share, so I want to share now.
Right.
No, I was just going to say, one of the things I thought for us was really good is because even though I had that injury, we started the AZT, and we can't, like, restrain ourselves. So if there's like camping at large, I think we did 6,000 feet descent and 4,000 feet elevation gain in the first day of the Arizona Trail. Mm-hmm. And it was like close to 16 miles, which is not what you should do on an injured leg. Like you should, everyone's like, start slow.
That's good medical advice.
Yeah. And so that was what they said. And that's what I did. But I think for us, it was really helpful because it was kind of like a good success story for us. I think it boosted us because we felt like we had failed this trail and like with this injury and
the Arizona
Trail, be able to do it. And then to come into this one and actually have designated campsites where, I'm going to end at that time. Mm-hmm. I think that's so good. And I think it helped us even when we planned this last weekend when we went camping, it was like, we're going to stop here or, we kind of make a plan
or else we're
just going to be like, well, I mean, how many more miles do you think we could get before it gets dark?
Yeah.
And that's not always the best way to go.
Yeah. It forces you to just be like, hey, stop here by the ocean and that's it. You can't camp anywhere else.
Yeah. It kind of goes back to your idea that it's not complete wilderness, right? You've got stores along the way. You've got designated campsites. You've got water, even a restaurant or two, which can make it a lot less threatening if you're in a situation like coming off an injury.
Yeah. You could get help pretty easily. There's a few remote spots, but you can get help.
Well, thank you guys for telling me about your hike on the Trans Catalina Trail. But before I let you go, I've got a few more questions.
Okay. We're ready.
You're ready. Okay. What is one piece of gear that you don't leave home without?
I want to hear yours first. Mine's pretty dumb, I think.
Oh, and I love this piece of gear. I'm like an evangelist.
Uh-oh, thunder.
Ooh, nice thunder. Yeah.
it's ominous for this piece of gear.
Can you give me hints? I'll try to guess what it is.
Give you hints.
Yeah.
I even take this piece of gear to work.
A shoehorn.
No. I do have a shoehorn, but no.
Okay, one more hint.
They don't want me to. Okay. No, I can't tell you. I forgot it on this trip, and that was my biggest regret of this trip.
The last one we did?
No, Catalina trip.
Catalina. I don't know.
I love my titanium long-handled spoon.
Oh yes, I forgot. It's you talk about the smooth bevel, like it describes
smooth,
on the packaging.
Yeah, it says it has a polished.
Okay, spoon. I have a question about this. Is this a spork or a spoon?
No, it's a spoon.
No spork.
Okay.
No, I spoon all my food.
Okay.
But yeah, I we got this for the Arizona Trail, and I was like, this is so light. I don't know why there's other things that I have that are light, but I just like love it. You can not get your knuckles dirty in those bags. And I complained probably. We got a
dirty
plastic
knuckles.
Spoon. And I was like the whole time, every meal is all stupid. I hate this. I can't believe I forgot it. I wanted to go back, but that was a long trip. So that's for me. I love my spoon. And if I I don't know why. It's just got to have a spoon.
All right. That's a good one.
I didn't even need this for this Catalina trip, but I love the Sawyer gallon water filter because it makes everything so easy. I have a way I tie it up to the tree and I dump a bunch of water in it and hook it to a 4-liter reservoir and then go do other things while it filters. And it's magical and I love it. And it's so light.
This is a gravity filter, right? Where you just set it up and walk away.
Yep, with the gallon reservoir and it's light. And I honestly don't know why people use any other filter because I used to have an MSR pump one and you have to work.
Yeah.
You have to work with this.
Okay.
We're lazy and we're campsite stealers.
Don't you know what? Hike with us. I'm leaving.
You know what? But it's a good point when you get into camp. Anything that can help conserve energy once you've done a long day of hiking is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, it's basically like having like a washing machine or something. You do this for me while I do other things.
And it's so, I'm always amazed at how light it is. And then it can filter quite a lot at one time, which is nice.
I love it so much.
Okay, what's the next trip that each of you want to do that's on your list?
My dream trip that I have to do, I think you had the big year where you did hike, you hiked for your significant birthday. You wouldn't tell us what. But yeah, I think before I turn a significant age that I won't mention because we don't mention ages here.
You can mention anything you want.
I don't want to tell everyone my age.
Okay.
Before she turns 20.
Yeah. And I really, really, this has been my dream hike for my whole life is to do the Yukon Trail.
So just roughly, how big of a trail is this? Is this a really long one?
No, it's only 35 miles.
Okay.
And it's
an old gold mining route and you hike from
like Klondike,
Skagway, Alaska, Skagway into Canada.
Oh, cool. That sounds neat.
I read a lot of books when I was young about, you know, all the people for the gold rush, and they would have to take these, there's a really big pass and they'd just have to carry all their stuff over it and then build a boat on the other side. I'm not planning on doing that, but I don't know though, if the mood strikes me, I might.
I don't know. You could steal someone else's boat.
Was that in the Jack London book about it? I think it might've been.
Yeah. So there was one. Yeah. I've read that one like 2 or 3 times because it's just like, it's amazing.
Cool.
Beth won't go because of grizzly bears.
I didn't say I won't go. I just need to mentally prepare.
She listens to too many podcasts about bears. And so now I'm like, our scope is getting limited of what we can do.
Well, tomorrow I leave for Canada and I'm going to Banff and I'm going to hike. So I will hopefully just calm my bear fears down.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah.
I think my absolute top that I really want to make happen is, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but Lycian Way in Turkey.
Yeah, that's on my list too.
Is it really?
Yeah.
300, the whole trail is about 300 miles of the coast and hiking through ancient ruins and little villages. And it just, I think if I did that, I'd be like, okay, I've done it.
Maybe I'll go with you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think he wants to hike with us.
The jury's still up. Maybe.
Another one I've recently discovered and been drooling over is in the Northwest Territories north of Canada. There's a Tombstone Territorial Park, and there's a backpacking loop you can do there. And it just looks out of this world, how gorgeous it is. So I want to make that one happen.
There's going to be grizzly bears if you do that.
There are. I read a lot of blogs, and they said, I never saw one.
Well, we will.
All right, last question. What is a backpacking meal you could be totally happy to never, ever eat again?
This one's unanimous.
It's Backpacker's Pantry, which I like a lot of their meals.
Usually they're good.
And it's the China Masala.
China Masala.
And it is...
Have you had this one?
No, I don't think I've had the Backpacker's Pantry version of China Masala, no.
You can.
Just
fine.
Pass.
Yeah. Okay, I have to ask you this though. What makes it so bad?
You know, it is indescribable. you cannot pinpoint what you don't like.
Indian food is hard to screw up. I mean, you put in a lot of spices and make it hot.
That
and,
is
you
so
know.
True.
But I feel like
they did it.
Congratulations, Backpackers.
So the thing is, we bought a bunch of meals for the Arizona Trail. We had everything planned out to hike 800 miles. We had a bunch of stuff left over, so we're using these meals. Well, this is the only one I literally can't stomach anymore.
I didn't
we took
even
it,
want to smell it.
We just backpacked on the Muggy on Rim last weekend, and she took it to share with a friend, and they both took two bites and were like, I'll eat some peanut butter.
I had tuna instead.
It's just, it's like, I can't even describe it.
It's just not good.
Let the listener,
It's like they put too many spices, I think, and then there's something sour. I don't know what it was. Something not right.
It's almost like a not taste. I don't know.
Yeah, it was.
I took it. My dad took it. My dad and I went to have a soup pie in February, and my dad took it, and he couldn't finish it.
He had like a few bites. Yeah, he had a few bites. He's all, I don't like it.
He's all, I'm a biscuits and gravy now.
Yeah. Okay. I think I will. I'll pass on that one.
Good.
Yeah. The other, their pad thai is good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, okay. Yeah. Maybe have the pad thai instead.
Yeah. Go with that for sure.
All right. Rachel and Beth Irvine, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to Rachel and Beth Irvine. And I hope that we've inspired you to hike the Trans Catalina Trail. And if you've enjoyed this episode, tell a friend about it. Or better yet, give us a good review on whichever podcast service you use. And keep in mind that this podcast is entertainment and meant to spark your interest. As I said earlier on the episode, if you decide to hike the trail, do your own research. Like anything else worth doing, outdoor adventure has risk. So when you go, pack your common sense. And when you get back, tell me how it went. Before we go, I want to remind you about our sponsor, Outdoor Herbivore. I've been on 3 backpacking trips in the last couple of months. And for each trip, every night for dinner, I ate Outdoor Herbivore meals. Outdoor Herbivore makes vegetarian and vegan backpacking meals, but as I always say, you don't need to be vegetarian or vegan to love these meals. They have high-quality ingredients. They're conveniently packaged in boil-in-a-bag pouches, where you can just pour in boiling hot water and let it sit for 10 minutes and your dinner is ready. And they're delicious. Trails Worth Hiking listeners get 10% off their order at Outdoor Herbivore with the discount code TWH10P, Trails Worth Hiking 10%. Outdoor Herbivore also sells bulk ingredients if you like to make your own meals, and they ship worldwide. So don't hesitate to order Outdoor Herbivore wherever you live. Outdoor Herbivore at outdoorherbivore.com. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we go back to the UK. We've covered iconic hikes in the UK like the West Highland Way and Hadrian's Wall Path. But this time we travel almost 80 miles along a path through the English countryside that is relatively undiscovered, so undiscovered that it could be the least known of Britain's national trails. We'll travel through wildflower-covered hills and valleys, vineyards and lavender farms, where we'll pass through vibrant market towns and medieval villages with welcoming pubs. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Yorkshire Wolds Way in Yorkshire, England. If you have any questions or feedback on this episode or ideas for future episodes, including if you want to be a guest and talk about a trail that you've hiked, reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at trailsworthhikingpodcast. So start planning your next hike, and before you know it, you'll be on the trail. Thanks for listening.